So PE, this is probably one of the most common things that is missed. We'll see why in a moment. And we often think of the deep leg veins, but there's another place you can think of, and I'm not expecting you to remember this, but if you did, it's good, that I've seen cases of, it's not that common, is the, you have a rich venous plexus in the males around the prostate as well as around the uterus. And I've seen in my clinical practice a couple of these, okay? But the most of the time, you think of the deep leg veins. Why the deep leg veins? They often, you have to think about the anatomy. Here's your anatomy becomes very important. Why do you think most deep leg vein thrombosis occurs below the knee versus above the knee? You did extremities this summer, right? All right. You're experts at this. Why you're taught in clinical medicine that the DVTs tend to occur below the knee rather than above the knee? I want to know why, based on the anatomy, is the answer. But how does that increase the likelihood occurring there versus in the thigh? That's what I'm asking, based on the anatomy.
The thigh muscles are used more often, so they...
Then your gastrocnemius? No.
Well, the muscles, compressive veins or causal
veins? No, because that occurs along the entire extremity. Not a bad try. What's unique about something below the knee versus the anatomy above the knee involving veins? Not smaller. Something else. This is critical. That's why I'm bringing this up. How do veins prevent blood from going backwards? Very good. This is the key. If I have a column of blood here, think of my leg as a column. Where do I see the greatest pressure? Above or below the knee? So where do you think you have the greatest density of valves is? Above or below the knee? Below. Because if I don't have the valves, a lot of them there, what's going to happen to the pressure? What's the likelihood of making those valves incompetent? Greater if I had just a few valves, wouldn't it? Because the pressure is higher versus the pressure up here. Does that make sense? So therefore, what type of valves are these? Tricuspid, bicuspid, or monocuspid? They're bicuspid valves. Okay. Now, if you have, and how thin, they're very thin, like a vein is very thin. So you can imagine if they're constantly being, blood is coming back to them, they can now become incompetent, right? Because they're very thin. And you get more pooling of blood. What happens to the likelihood of thrombus formation occurring now? There you go. It goes up. So I can explain why it occurs because of the anatomy you learned. If you go in there, you'll notice you have a lot of valves right below the knee because you have all the highest pressure because you don't want that to pool there. Otherwise, what happens to hydrostatic pressure? Increases. What do you get in your feet all the time then? Swelling. You don't want that. Can you imagine? It'd be a big problem, wouldn't it? Our shoes would never fit properly. We have to wear sandals all the time. The flip-flops. Does that make sense now? So, and you also, because of this number of valves and you have all this backflow trying to go backwards, you can cause micro-injury and promote thrombus formation. That's another reason. And there's also collaterals from the deep leg veins to the superficial veins. And so now if the valves are, you're pushing against those valves, it can shunt blood to the superficial veins and now they become varicosities. Okay? That makes sense? So use your anatomy. It's sexy stuff. Because then you can explain. I always tell this to students. I was this way when I was a medical student. Be that child that's 6 years old that you're in wonderment of the world. And you ask, why is the sky blue? Why is the water blue today? It was green yesterday. You always, as a clinician, want to be a child. Because you want to have that inquisitive aspect to it. Don't let any exam drown it out of you or the system, because your patient will benefit and you'll be learning a lot. Always ask the why question. If they can't answer it, go to the internet, go to the next person, but do not stop asking the why. Why is it blue? It's purpuric. It's blood. Why is it green, yellow, black? Why does it occur here, not over here? See what I'm saying? You always want to be that child. I'm always a big kid. That's why I wear tennis shoes the rest of my life. Okay. All right. So why does 70-80% resolve? Because they're small and the fibrotic pathway takes care of them. We talked about this. 10-15%, if they occlude a certain part of the lung circulation, and lead to an infarct. If it occludes the vessels and they become organized, what happens to the blood flow resistance? It increases, because organization means what? Scar tissue. And what happens to blood flow? Decreases. What happens to their intraluminal pressure? And then now what's going to happen? You develop pulmonary hypertension. And which side of the heart's going to work harder, left or right? The right, because it's the pulmonary arteries. Right, because that's what leads the heart. And then what's death? When you have a mass of PE, 50 centimeters, a mat that occludes the pulmonary trunks, and you can't oxygenate, get any blood supply to the left side of the heart because you've obstructed it. Here's the mass of PE. This is what it looks like. What I'm showing you is that autopsy. So we remove the heart from the pericardial sac, and here's the inferior vena cava. Here is the right pulmonary artery, and here's the left pulmonary artery, and it's completely occluded by a pulmonary embolus. So no blood is getting through the lungs. Therefore, what happens to the volume of blood returning to the left atrium? What happens to stroke volume? Goes down. What happens to cardiac output? And what happens to your blood pressure? Right, that's it. You're done. Yes?
So does saddle mean that it's both right and left?
Okay. Right. Like, so think like you're riding on a horse. Right leg, left leg. Right pulmonary artery, left pulmonary artery. So it went down both at the same time. Remember, it's 50 centimeters like a snake. So one part of the end of the snake goes this way, the other part goes this way. You're done. So there's the right pulmonary artery, main, completely occluded. There's the left. That's what caused this death acutely. That's why people, because what happens to perfusion? What's the first organ that can't be perfused? Is your brain. That's why you become unconscious and die. Just like that. It's that quick. Constantly begun moving. So an infarct. It's a localized area of necrosis, circulatory, as we finish up. Heart, brain, and lungs collectively account for more deaths than all cancers and infectious disease in the United States. So what's the most common form of cell injury? See? It's hypoxia. Okay? So an infarct can be due to what? A thrombus, an embolus, or shock. Complete circulatory collapse. I can't get blood flow to any tissue. And we'll talk about that. So the degree of obstruction, if it's 5% or 100%, it's going to dictate how severe the acute hypoxia is. And if it's slowly going on, then the ability of the cells to adapt. Atrophy, right? Because if you have decreased blood flow through a partially occluded vessel, you're going to get atrophy, decrease of the structural proteins, or organelles. What cells? Now, the way you think of this, what cells in the human body have a lot of mitochondria in them? Because mitochondria is what needs oxygen to produce what? A lot of ATP. So what cells in the human body need a lot of ATP, a lot of mitochondria in order to produce it? Cardiac muscle? Not so much skeletal, because they use glycogen. They can live under anaerobic metabolism. You're using it right now to figure out the answer. What cells in the brain? Neurons. You just had breakfast. What cell has to work? Well, what part of the GI? The liver. Hepatocytes. They make all those clotting factors. Okay? Kidney. Making all that pee all the time. Really, it's easy to do to make pee. It takes a lot of ATP. You have a lot of mitochondria in your nephron. So that's why you'll see this will lead to infarct. Collateral circulation. What are organs that have collateral circulation you think of? Well, you have collateral circulation around the knee, don't you? From the popliteal. You have collateral circulation in the lungs. You have bronchial artery, pulmonary artery. You have in the intestine, vascular arcades. You have the portal vein, hepatic artery. So that'll dictate how that plays a role in infarct. If you have disease, vasculitis, atherosclerosis, or how the patient's able to survive, depending upon the comorbidities. Infarct is wedge-shaped because when I think of my hand, think of it like a proximal artery. When it gives off branches, it arborizes, right? So if I occlude it here, what's the shape of this going to be? Wedge shape. The occlusion is here. Everything in this distribution dies. So it's wedge-shaped infarct. They never talk about infarct, wrong class. You don't have to memorize the colors, but if you have loose tissues and you have venous occlusion, the blood accumulates, or the tissue like the lung dies and extravasates blood. If you have one single artery going to a organ, it'll be pale. It has no color as it dies and then breaks down the pigment, whatever making the color. Single blood supply, arterial occlusion, like a heart attack, coronary artery. Spleen has one artery. Kidney, one artery. So gross pathology, this is just a list. I'll show you examples. It'll be pale or anemic, loses color as the tissue dies. The brain can be hemorrhagic or pale in a situation where you have a lot of blood flow to the brain. If it dies, you can get secondary hemorrhage because the blood vessels die in that infarcted area. Lung is highly vascularized, dual blood supply. Intestine, vascular arcades, it's hemorrhagic as it dies. The spleen, one single artery. These are just examples, not to be memorized. Here's what it looks like grossly. This is the lung. Here you see a large pulmonary embolus, and you see this area that's very hemorrhagic. It's dead. It's a massive pulmonary infarct. What do you think they'll be coughing up? They could be coughing up blood, because as the alveolar sacs die, all that blood's pouring into the alveolar sacs, and they could be coughing up blood. Hemoptysis is the clinical term. Here's an infarct in the heart. Here it's fixed. It normally should be pale, but because they have hemorrhage into the tissue, it is this it's secondary hemorrhage into the infarcted area. This is the small intestine. What's the normal color of your small intestine? What's the color here? If we were to take a peek in your abdominal cavity right now, what color is your intestine right now if we looked at it? Pink. You're all pinky inside, even the pathologist. But now when it dies, what color does it become? Hemorrhagic, and then eventually it can turn black, like a gangrenous foot. So this is an infarct to the small intestine. This happens to be the spleen. Here you have a capsule. Here's the red pulp and the white pulp. But what do you notice? The last place to get oxygen is the first place to die is underneath the capsule. What's the shape? Wedge shape. So on a CT, can you see this on a CT scan? Yes, you see wedge shape. Structures in the spleen underneath the capsule, you'd call those infarcts. That's how they're able to make the diagnosis. Okay. This is a fresh spleen, and the spleen is, when it's sitting against the underneath the diaphragm, it has this convex appearance to it. Here's this is the hilum of the spleen with the tail of the pancreas and the splenic artery and vein. And you can see the red pulp, and you can see these infarcts. This is the kidney. The kidney is fresh. Here's the papillae going in the calyces. It's going to go into the renal pelvis to your ureters. And here's the medulla. Here's the cortex. And you can see, what's the shape of it? Wedge shape. Because it's a distribution. Everything distal to it is not getting any blood, and it dies and get coagulant necrosis. So infarcts. What type of necrosis is associated with hypoxia is coagulant necrosis. And then the brain, because it doesn't have fibroblasts, it can't form. It's very soft like jello. So when it infarcts, it goes through liquefaction. Because macrophages come in after the PMNs and breaks down the brain, and it liquefies it. It becomes a whole. What's the first cell to arrive when you have dead tissue? Neutrophils followed by macrophage. See all that good stuff? And then you get granulation tissue. What type of collagen is being formed around the infarct and granulation tissue? Type 3. Then it's going to be converted to type 1. There was that tissue repair. And you get fibrosis. And what does all scar tissue do? Contract because of cross-linking. All the things we talked about. I'm just using it. See, what I'm giving you the key foundation. Once we finish this neoplasia, we just go to the different organ systems. I can use those same principles over and over again. The only thing that changes are the names and the consequences based on the biochemistry, the physiology, the anatomy of that particular organ, its function, and what happens when you damage it. That's the essence of the second half of the course, by the way. We're just going to repeat it over and over again, like an old friend to come and visit you that you wish you would leave. Then so this is an infarct. We have coagulant necrosis, and we have thousands and thousands of neutrophils coming in. Because who's the first cell to arrive when there's dead tissue? The innate immune system, the neutrophils. Then what do we see? Who follows neutrophils? Macrophages. Who orchestrates tissue repair? Macrophages. And what do we see? VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, be released. We have blood vessels, because what's the color of granulation tissue? It's red to pink. Angiogenesis and fibroblasts making what type of collagen? Type 3. And here we see the coagulant necrosis where it's being replaced. And then what does it become? Scar? And what is all scar tissue? It's hard to see in this light, but this is all scarred down. It's white and it contracts down. So this is a renal cortical infarct. Hemorrhage comes in many different flavors. So these are terms you're going to see clinically, because bleeding is a common entity in many type of conditions. What's the size of these when I say petechiae? Pinpoint. Bruising. They're larger than pinpoint. And what's the color? Purple. That's why we use the term what? Purpura. There it is. Epitaxis is another name for it. And what's the most common cause? See, you know that? You can do it at a party. Oh, I know something I learned today. And now by organ systems. I'm vomiting up blood. What do we call that? Hematemesis. So it tells you what organ system? GI. Right, that's where it's coming from. If you cough up blood from the respiratory tract, it's coming from, and what do we call that? Hemoptysis. Very common. You're going to see patients that come in. Means they're telling you what organ system, upper or lower respiratory tract. Melena is black tarry stools, because the blood gets exposed to your acid, hydrochloric acid in your stomach. It gets hemolyzed to color black. So when they say melena, it means it's an upper GI bleed. Since you don't have acid in your small and large intestine, then it's going to be red. If it's bright red blood, this is another word, hematochezia. I had a patient once who his wife, he was having a cup of red blood, a cup of blood in the toilet every day for 2 straight months. And he refused to go to the doctor, despite his wife. Does it normally have a cup of bright red blood in your toilet every day if you stool? The answer is obviously no. So eventually he collapsed at the toilet one day on the 60th day. He came in with a hematocrit of 10. Normally should be 45. He died of hypovolemic shock. Where was the source of bleeding? He has a cancer about this big that was ulcerating in his rectum. And it was only one metastatic lesion to his liver. He would have been curable. Yes.
So if it's bright red, it's coming from lower down?
Yes.
But if it's black, it's upper.
Because it's been exposed to what? The acid. Because it oxidizes the hemoglobin in red blood cells to give it a black color. Okay? Obviously, hematuria, blood in what organ system?
Renal.
Bladder, kidneys, ureters, can't tell. There's ways, but then if you bleed into a cavity, hemothorax, into the pleural, hemopericardium, pericardial sac, hemoperitoneum, in your peritoneal cavity. So those are the classic body cavities. And then hematoma is what? Localized bleeding, clotting of blood into a body cavity or a tissue. Is the hematoma. Those are the vocabulary. See how many words for one thing in medicine? Bleeding. So it's going to be unique to each organ system. Okay. Shock. The last part of this hemodynamic derangement. It means, will you hear about patients who are in shock? Yes. And so when you think of this, we have widespread hyperperfusion. So what form of cell injury would that lead to? Hypoxia. Okay. Now it's global, not just localized, like an infarct. It's due to decreased blood volume or decreased blood pressure, or cardiac output is not there, where you can't distribute it. And if the redistribution can't occur, then you can't meet the metabolic needs of your cells throughout the body. That's how you think of shock. When I think of physiology, I think of this formula, because this is how you evaluate people who are hypotensive. Blood pressure, cardiac output times total peripheral resistance. Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume. That's the formula for it. So any of these factors that makes that blood pressure, if the heart is something abnormal, can't pump out the blood effectively, whatever the reason, you lead to hypotension or shock. If you don't have enough arterial resistance or capillary arterial, then your blood pressure goes down. What happens to your ability to provide oxygen? Decrease, leading to global hypoxia. Okay? That's how you think of this. The opposite is also true, is hypertension. If I increase the heart rate, I increase peripheral resistance, what happens to your blood pressure? What happens when you exercise? What happens to your blood pressure? Every time, no matter what exercise you do, it increases. Exactly. So shock can be broken down into decreased, this is not to be memorized, but just think about it. I got another way. How many people like nachos? Good. I'll show you how nachos fits into the shock. Okay, decreased volume. I hemorrhage, that's obvious. What's another way to lose volume is to vomit and diarrhea from the GI tract. Remember, 75% of our what's the most common molecule found in our body? 75% of our existence is based on what molecule? Water. We're made of H2O. We're walking jellos, walking down the street. Different consistencies. So therefore, if I lose water by hemorrhage, vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration, severe burns because the capillaries become leaky, I lose a lot of volume. These are common things, especially the old and the very young can go into shock by vomiting and diarrhea at the same time. So this is something you always have to think about. Everybody's carrying their bottles of water around, trying to avoid dehydration. If you have a normal blood volume, what's going to affect? The heart. These are examples. An infarct, massive PE, because what happens to blood getting to the left side of the heart if you have a massive PE? Decrease, stroke volume is down, shock. Neurogenic shock. Who's the famous person who died of neurogenic shock? Is Michael Jackson. What drug was he given? A general anesthetic. When you take general anesthesia, what happens to your blood pressure when you're in an operation? Oh, yeah. And now if you're giving an anesthetic at home, not a good idea to treat insomnia. So he died of neurogenic shock besides other drugs that lowered his blood pressure. So he's a poster child for neurogenic shock. If you have spinal cord injury or CNS injury, what happens to the autonomic nervous system? It's decreased output. What controls the circulation? Autonomic nervous system. So if the autonomic nervous system is wiped out, what happens to your ability to control blood pressure? Can't go into shock. So head trauma. Sepsis, because you release cytokines that are vasodilators, affect the heart rate. Endotoxic shock. DIC, remember? DIC we talked about, you consume all those platelets, you start bleeding, and you're losing volume, you can go into shock as a complication. And you're going from aerobic to anaerobic metabolism as a consequence. So this is septic shock to show you when you release all these cytokines, that's the endotoxin at the top from the bacteria. And what you're going to do is that you'll create so much of this, it's polypharmacia, that it actually acts as a negative ionotropic effect on contractility. In other words, your heart slows down because of this cytokine as a consequence to this. Then you can form what? DIC, you damage endothelial cells. You can get shock again, bleeding out. Primary platelet thrombi, or you damage the endothelial cells in your lung, you get acute respiratory distress syndrome. Damage the endothelial cells. So it's a real problem. Hypoxia all over the place. Okay? Nachos. Here's the way to remember it. If somebody's in shock, what does N stand for? Neurogenic shock. Have they taken a drug that lowers their blood pressure? A general anesthetic or spinal cord injury. So I think of neurogenic. Has somebody have a severe allergic reaction, hypersensory reaction type what? One, anaphylactic shock. Penicillin or allergic to. Somebody gives it to them. Liberant, it can be anything. What does C stand for? Cardiogenic shock. Something wrong with the heart. Could be anything. Cocaine overdose can cause cardiogenic shock. Arrhythmia, methamphetamine, heart attack. Anything that damages that pump, you can lead to shock. Because you remember, cardiac output is diminished. You don't have enough blood pressure. Hypovolemic shock, bleeding, vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration. This is hypovolemic shock. Then O, massive PE, obstructing blood flow through the lungs, leading to decreased blood volume to the left side of the heart. What happens to your blood pressure? Shock. And last but not least, S4, sepsis. The patient has a bacterial infection, all these cytokines be released that diminishes the heart rate, cardiac output, as well as total peripheral resistance relaxes. And now you have decreased blood pressure, leading to what form of injury in all of these? Hypoxia. Okay? So what happens to the organs? They go into shock kidney, the tubule epithelium, they have a lot of mitochondria, they die. The lungs get damaged. We'll talk about this when we get to the lung section. Alveolar damage, acute lung injury, or the central part of the liver lobular unit where the last place to get oxygen is zone 3. And there can be central lobular necrosis. And then you can cause TPA, DIC as a complication of shock when it's septic. So, in summary, what form of injury we've been talking about for the last, these lectures that we've gone over in terms of fluid and hemodynamic derangement? One, edema. We have too much fluid in our tissues, those five mechanisms. We also have to worry about congestion. We have passive versus active. Passive leads to hypoxia, active like acute inflammation, more oxygen. We talk about hemostasis. We spent a lot of time on this, didn't we? But is it important? Yes. Then we talk about hemostasis. We talked about, where did I have my? Embolus and thrombus. There it is. It's in your vascular space. And last but not least, infarct and hemorrhage and shock. What's the form of cell injury in all these situations? Hypoxia. Once you know one, you know all the, there's, you can see why it's the most common form of cell injury, right? Hypoxia. Okay? And that is fluid and hemodynamic derangements. Any questions? If not, I'll have some this weekend with patients and things. All right, let's go on to this, neoplasia. And we'll continue this tomorrow. But how many people have not heard about neoplasia or cancer? Good. You're experts then. How many people know anybody in their family or friends that have had neoplasia? Raise your hands. It's pretty common, isn't it? So I'm going to give you an overview. And when you think of neoplasia, it has various images. See, x-rays, causes like smoking, crab, it's infiltrating. You have things like bladder cancer. You got all these various colors for breast cancer, right? Prostate cancer, all these. And then skin cancer. Then we think of, how do you make the diagnosis? Biopsy. That's the gold standard in medicine, is a biopsy. Looking at the structure or individual cells. You can see individual cells here as a reflection of neoplasia. So that's where we're going to concentrate on these concepts. As we go through the various organ systems, we'll look at more specific examples and why they occur. So neoplasia, we have to define this precisely. There are two parts of this definition. Neo means what?
New.
What does plasia mean? Growth. So why do we get this neoplasia? It means this abnormal growth or abnormal tissue whose growth exceeds and is uncoordinated within that particular tissue it arises from. Basically, this is cellular anarchy or antisocial behavior at the cellular level. The second component is what? If whatever caused this, which we're going to go through that, if you remove the cause, it still persists. So what does that tell you? It tells you this is purely a genetic disease. Because once you cause mutations in various genes called proto-oncogenes, tumor suppressor genes, it's irreversible. So knowing this definition, what's the best way to deal with neoplasia? If you understand this concept, how do you get rid of neoplasia in the human population? No, it's too late. If you know what the cause is, what you can do now? Prevent it. This is what I'm telling you. To get rid of neoplasia in the human population, the vast majority is what? Preventable. What do you think is the most common human cancer on this planet? Skin. What causes it? That's right. So you're getting this fluorescent suntan, you're preventing skin cancer. So you're putting money in the bank. And, you know, avoiding wrinkles, too. See, there's all these benefits you're getting, staying indoors. It's true. What do you think is the most common cause of lung cancer? Smoking. Is that preventable? Yeah. 2/3 of human cancers can be traced to chemical carcinogens in the environment we're exposed to. 2/3. If you go in the literature and looked at all the causes, you'd find that to be true. The food we eat, the air we breathe, the things we take in. A lot of this is preventable. Or vaccinations for HPV, for cervical cancer. Most common cause is HPV. So knowing what causes are, hepatitis B for hepatocellular carcinoma. So a lot of this, the way, because when, how are you going to fix a genetically damaged cell? Go in there and repair it microscopically? Cutting out, no guarantee either, is it? Get reoccurrence, it's metastasized. So the key concept is you want to do what? Prevent it. This is the critical part. Because once it starts, your options become less, and you'll see why. Okay? In terms of epidemiology, what's the second leading cause of death in both pediatric and adults is neoplasia. What's number one in adults is ischemic heart disease, but it's on the decline. That's good. The second leading cause of death in children is neoplasia, but what's the leading? Accidents is number one. Are accidents preventable? Guns in the house, running in the street, not wearing a helmet. A lot of things. So you have to remember, it's not important what you can, you want to be able to think. If you know what the cause of disease is and you can prevent it, that's what I'd do first. Because everything after that is going to cost money, isn't it? And utilization of resources. So you want to prevent it. So how many people die in this year? Get diagnosed with new case of cancer in the United States is 1,685,540. In this year, this is the number for females and males. If you ask, and now what's not in this number is skin cancers, like basal cell and squamous cell, that represents over 1 million new cases alone. So if you were to look at the total number of cancers, it's roughly 3 million cancers. You include skin as well. Now, what causes, what happens to people who die in the United States, there's roughly about over 1.2 to 0.3 million people die in the United States. Of those people who die in the United States, one out of every four will die of cancer. You're more likely to die of cancer than win the lotto or be hit by a bolt of lightning. So that's why this is a critical part of this foundational information to understand the global problem. It's not just this country, but around the world. This is not to memorize. So how do we think of cancer? We know it's genetically occurring. So we have to think of why do we get certain cancers in various organs? We're going to think about it in a very basic principle. If you think of cell biology and you think of DNA replication, is it 100% fidelity to it? No. So if we understand that, that means if I have more cells dividing all the time, what happens to mutation rates? Goes up. That's the key concept. If you can remember that, I can now explain any human cancer, why they occur at certain ages, by knowing that saying. So where do you think the cancer cells arise in? Non-stem cells or stem cells in the body? Stem cells, because they're doing what? Self-renewing. So if you damage them with a virus, a chemical, or radiation, of the stem cells, what's the likelihood of getting neoplasia? Increase. That's the first thing. So let's look at these lists. You notice that you always taught who's the most common cancer in adult males is prostate. Everyone knows about breast, but why? What are those two organs constantly been exposed to are hormones. So what are hormones? They're mitogenic. So what have these tissues been doing for decades? Dividing. So what do you think is accumulating every decade? Mutations. And once those mutations reach a critical mass, now you're going to get neoplasia. Because when do you get breast cancer? What age? Classically, without having any genetic predisposition. 40s and 60s, because you've been exposed to what during reproductive life? Estrogen. It's mitogenic. Your breast, uterine. What has the male been exposed to that hormone is going to target your prostate? Testosterone. So that's why we see this, because we're driving cells. And if we drive cells to divide, what happens to mutation rates? So that's why we have to have good repair enzymes to repair it, but minimize that. What do you see, number two? Lung cancer. Well, 85% is due to what? Exposure to carcinogens. And if you have mutations already there. What kills both men and women because they smoke is lung cancer. Why? Do you have nerve endings in your lung? No. So you can have any disease in the lung and you won't feel it because it's not have innervation. But if you have a disease in your skin, you can see it and you can feel it because it's highly innervated. So pain is good. Without that pain, we have a problem. What's a group of people that have a real problem when they don't know a disease process? Or diabetics, because they have sensory neuropathies. They are really up a creek. So pain is an alarm system the human body uses. And if you have an organ that's less innervated, then that's why you can have, like Hillary Clinton, for example. Everybody's coming back. She didn't know she had pneumonia. She probably didn't feel it, except the cytokines being released. And then they, oh, you got pneumonia, by the way. But if there was pain in the lungs, receptors, you would have known it. So where's the lung located? In the chest cavity. And because it's highly vascularized, that's why it tends to invade locally and metastasize. Highly vascularized because a lot of blood leaves it. So that's why, in terms of deaths, those are the worst. In terms of trends of tumors, this is just a story thought to be memorized. We have female on the left and males. Obviously, curves that go down are good curves, right? Curves that go up, not so good in terms of cancer. So here's the yellow for stomach cancer. Here's the yellow for stomach cancer. What was the major cause that why is this decreasing? Even before organic foods was removal of carcinogens from the food. Smoked vegetables, smoked fish. Because when you burn organic material, you're coating it with carcinogens. Next time you go to a barbecue and you see all that black around it. And those, it's all covered with carcinogens. I hate to put a damper on things, but it is. So that's why we removed it before they said organic. Worry about pesticides. Even before that, you see they're going down. But you notice this curve is uterine cancer. What test was given to decrease cervical cancer is a Pap test. So here we instituted. They didn't know it was HPV. But now that rates can even go lower now, because what are they doing to boys and girls? They're vaccinated with HPV. Now, what do you notice about this one is lung cancer. This is not. Why do you think lung cancer went up in the 60s and 70s? What was occurring in the 60s and 70s in the United States and around the world? Go down. You weren't even born, right? What happened historically? You learn in history. What happened? You can go back in history, even in high school. Women's liberation. It started. So what do they want to have? Their own cigarettes. So they made Virginia Slims during this time. They kept the cancer. They should have kept it to the men. Yeah, we'll take everything else. So what the point I'm trying to make is, as clinicians, you're going to see trends in society that's either going to prevent disease or create diseases. Think you want one thing, you'll get something else, depending upon what you choose. I would take equal pay and everything else. Forget the smoke. You can keep that. I don't want that. It's going to cause damage. But you can see that. Now, here you see stomach cancer. But what do you notice about cigarette smoking and lung cancer went really high in the 30s and 40s? Why was that? Movies. When you saw Humphrey Bogart and all these actors, what were they doing to attract the men? They were suave and sophisticated. They were doing what? Smoking. That was a sign of affluence, a sign of power. Well, power to get lung cancer. What I'm trying to make the point is, now we have vaping. Is that going to cause lung cancer? Yes. There's only three gases the lung wants to see: nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon dioxide. Anything else? Anybody says this is safe is not telling the truth. Period. So you have to really think about society causes cancers based on social norms. And so are they preventable? Yes. So when we talk about excess of growth, we have two types. Remember we talked about cell adaptation, hyperplasia, metaplasia? that pleasure. But what was the difference between that? It was reversible. Take wherever the stimulus that caused it, you potentially could reverse it. But neoplasia, because it's genetically altered, what happens to its reversibility? It can't. Once you, that's why neoplasia, this new growth, will persist after you take away the stimulus. You stop smoking, you still have mutations in your lung. Yes. You stop going in the sun, you still have mutations in your stem cells. Once those mutations occur, there's no genetic way to reverse it, and it becomes a real problem. And so what are most tumors? Benign, because they don't do what? Metastasize or invade. But what's the good thing is that most benign tumors tend not to acquire further genetic changes and become now malignant, where they invade and metastasize. Okay? How many people have a mole on their body somewhere? Those are all what? Benign or malignant? Benign. Okay? Will they become malignant? Very low. Unless you go out in the sun and cause further genetic damage to that mole, then yes. Or if you have a big nevus birthmark that's this big, you have more cells dividing, what happens to mutation rate? Little chiquito mole, not a problem. It's the grandes that you got to worry about. Remember, this is a purely a genetic disease. Okay? All right. So these are just terms. Do not have to memorize this. I'm not going to do it. When you have choriostoma, oma meaning swelling, or like tumor, remember we used that in terms of edema. This is normal tissue or ectopic. Ectopia means, like, for example, you have pancreatic tissue in your wall of your stomach. That's normal, so that's not neoplastic. Heterotopia, it's different tissue in the normal tissue. You could have not only pancreas in the wall of your duodenum or in your stomach, that's an example of ectopia. If you had bone growing in your heart muscle, is it normal to have bone in your heart? No, that's unusual for that. Another term for a swelling of normal tissue for a site is hamartoma. It means excess of growth of tissue for that. Is cartilage normally found in your lung? The answer is yes, because you have cartilage in your bronchi, that's like your trachea. Could you have a little nodule of cartilage in your lung? Yes, that would be a hamartoma because it's normally found there. So hamartomas is excess of growth of one component of that tissue. Is that pre-neoplastic? No. Another one is hyperplasia. Is this reversible? Yes, because hyper means what? Increased number of cells. Take away the stimulus, goes back. Hypertrophy, increase the size of a cell. Is that reversible? Yes, because the structural protein, the organelles. But then we come to metaplasia. Is this reversible? Yes. Remember we talked about changing one cell type for another. That's reversible. Now dysplasia is a term, dysfunctional growth, or loss of size and shape and orientation to the cells. Can this, it's acquiring genetic changes. Can this go on to neoplasia? Yes. Like HPV can give you cervical dysplasia. And then you add more mutations, then it can become neoplasia. But is dysplasia reversible? Yes. That's why you should not equal neoplasia with dysplasia, but dysplasia can lead to neoplasia. Do you think hyperplasia could lead to neoplasia? Yeah, because what happens to mutation rate if you have dividing cells? Can metaplasia go on to become cancer? Right, because you have growth, plasia. So in certain situations, you could go on to neoplasia. Okay. So here's the example of the cervix. This is dysplasia. If you think of cervical dysplasia due to HPV, here are the normal cells. Look at the number of nuclei, the basal layer, the nuclei perpendicular. And then what do you notice about the number of cells here compared to the normal? Increase, so there's the plasia part. What's dysfunctional is you notice these nuclei are bigger compared to the nuclei over here. So there's a loss of orientation and size. They're perpendicular. And this is what a pathologist, when they get a biopsy like this, they would say this is dysplasia. And when we talk about the characteristics of neoplasia, you'll see the difference. So So this is what HPV can do to your cervix as the virus infects the stem cells, whether it's in a male or female that has squamous epithelium. Okay? Dysplasia. Does that equal neoplasia? No, because it is potentially reversible. Very good. Nomenclature for benign, yes.
Sorry, just going back to OMA, you said it means swelling?
Now, I will show you. Right now, nomenclature. How many people have seen diagnosis of patients who have some type of neoplasia? Will you see this? Yes. So now we're going to use the how we break the words down. When it's a benign tumor, OMA, like tumor, remember tumor, like we had edema. So OMA, when you see that in the stem, it means it's a benign tumor. For example, if it's gland forming, an adenoma. Adeno means gland. This is where the medical dictionary. If it's coming from squamous cells, we call it squamous papilloma. There's the OMA. Lipoma, what cell is that? Fat cells. Very common. So this is a benign tumor of fat cells. If it's a smooth muscle cell tumor, a lyo meaning smooth, myo meaning what? Muscle. Rhabdo means striated muscle. So you get benign tumor skeletal muscle. So you can take any cell in the human body and you put an OMA behind it, it's benign. In general, there's some exceptions to it. Okay. Now we come to malignant. Now what cells are dividing all the time in the human body in various organ systems are epithelial cells because they have a what? A lot of stem cells. Your skin, your respiratory tract, your oral cavity, your vagina, the cervix, the endometrium, fallopian tube, the epithelial cells in your body cavities, the epithelial cells in your GI tract, respiratory tract, urinary tract. So 90% of tumors that are malignant come from what cells? Epithelial. So the term that's used for epithelial cancers is the word carcinoma. When I think of breast carcinoma, I'm involving what? The epithelial cells of the ducts and glands. If I think it's penile cancer, it's going to be the squamous cells of the penis. Or cervical cancer, the epithelial cells of the stratified squamous epithelium. So when you hear carcinoma or prostate cancer, it's arising from what? The epithelial cells or glands of the prostate. So carcinoma means it's malignant, can invade and metastasize. And so we think of adenocarcinoma. See that, the difference between adenocarcinoma versus adenoma? See the difference between the two? OMA is benign, unless it says malignant in front of it. And then squamous cell carcinoma versus a papilloma that's squamous. Then those that are non-epithelial, we use the word sarcoma. So an epithelial cell is defined as a cell that sits on a basement membrane. Fat cells don't sit on a basement membrane. Macrophages don't sit on a basement. Leukemia is a type of sarcoma. You think of a fibrosarcoma, fibroblasts. Or what do you think malignant fat tumor would be called? Liposarcoma. If it's fibroblast, a fibrosarcoma. What would you call benign? Fibroma. See, there is your OMAs versus carcinoma. Or sarcoma. This is a table that's in your syllabus. You can take any cell in the body and you can see the corresponding benign and corresponding what? Malignant. So here's an example of squamous papilloma. If it's malignant, we call it a squamous cell carcinoma. If you call it a hepatic adenoma, benign tumor of hepatocytes, when we call it a carcinoma, it's a hepatocellular carcinoma. If you look at a lipoma, there's your liposarcoma. And if you look at a leiomyoma, the most common tumor of the female genital tract arising from the uterus, versus a leiomyosarcoma malignant. And so these are the terms, and when you have patients that have these conditions, that's how you want to think about it. So here's a birthmark. How many people have a birthmark that looks similar to that? It can be darkly pigment, light, right? That, and birthmark means nevus, by the way. Most are acquired, born with, but what stimulates nevi, moles, is sunlight, by the way. So if you want to have more moles and you get moles, to stay out in the sun. That's how you get moles from. And this is benign or malignant, just looking at it compared to a mole. Doesn't that look infiltrative? So this is malignant melanoma. We'll talk more about it when we get to skin cancer. All right, in summary, before we leave, 90% of all cancers arise from epithelial cells. You have a lot of stem cells. What happens to replication rate? What happens to mutation rate? What are chemicals carcinogens going to be exposed to? Epithelial cells, viruses, radiation. So that's why skin cancer, epithelial cells. And then leukemias arising in the bone marrow and lymphocytes in lymphoid tissue, lymphomas. Majority of benign tumors do not go to malignant. That's a safe thing. On that note, we'll break at this point, continue on tomorrow, finish it up. Any questions? This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.